All right. Good evening. All right, we're here for our last week of this four-week teaching series on Christ and culture. If you've been with us, we have, we started with talking about what the problem is, right? Division and disunity in the church. We talked about what we're going to do to combat that, which is learn about these other views through culture models. And we talked about what the eventual goal is, which is humility. And so that first week was about setting the stage for what we would talk about the rest of the time. Now, in the second and third weeks, the last 2 weeks, we've covered the five culture models, ways in which to think about the relationship between Christ and culture. And so real quick, we have Christ against culture, a withdrawal model of removing oneself from the culture into the community of the church. It's focused on the church reacting to the evil of culture by showing its otherness. Second, we looked at the Christ of culture, an accommodationist model that recognizes God at work in the culture and looks for ways to affirm this. So it focuses on affirming the culture as the way that God is progressing things, right? So looking for the good and trying to push that forward. Third, we looked at the Christ above culture, a synthetic model that advocates supplementing and building on the good of culture, focused on building on and completing what the culture has begun. So it kind of makes up that difference with the church, with what the church is doing. Fourth, we looked at the Christ and culture in paradox. It's a dualistic model. It looks at kind of these two kingdoms, one sacred, one secular, focused on being a citizen of both earth as a human being and heaven as a child of God. And then we looked at Christ transforming culture, which is a conversionist model that seeks to transform every part of culture with Christ. And so it's focused on our role as reconcilers and redeemers of culture, that we are sent into the world to change it. And so these are the five models we looked at. And to compare these, we kind of did these side-by-side charts. Hopefully you got those, all the kind of different categories. Another way to easily identify the differences in these is to take kind of a single cultural element and go, okay, how would that element be viewed through all these different models? A commonly used example is the computer, right? So let's think about a computer. Let's think about kind of the information of a computer. Christ against culture, the Christian would see the computer as just one more instance of depravity, one more example of how sin infects everything we do. So the view of the computer would be, oh, let's keep that computer away. It's just bringing all that filth into our home. Christ of culture, the computer is simply an extension of God's good creation put here for us to develop and use as we wish. The computer is a good thing. Look at all the good that it does. We should celebrate it. We should align ourselves with it. Christ above culture would look at the computer and see it as a fine product of culture, but it could never approach the sublime beauty of Christ. And so while it's wonderful, it's not complete. It's not everything. The church needs to come in to finish it. Christ and culture and paradox, the computer may be used, but with care not to indulge too deeply, right? So it's this part of culture, it's great, but you don't want to overuse it. It still has its sinful problems and can infect. And Christ transforming culture views the computer as an extension of God's good creation with wondrous potential. It also exhibits the deep effects of sin. And so Christians are called to transform information technology in the name of Christ, right? So basically, kind of the computer is sort of neutral. It's how you use it. And so if you use it for good, then it can be transformed and redeemed. Now, a computer is a relatively easy thing to kind of put through that because you can go, well, I might not agree with this view or I might not agree with this view. It doesn't really affect you, right? That doesn't really offend you that somebody else wants to throw a computer out the window or have a dumb phone, whatever it is, right? Right? That's not really an offensive thing. So let me offend you a little bit more. Let's go ahead and take something that's a little more controversial and view it through all these models. I don't know, what is something that has divided the church over the last year? Mask mandates. Let's look at mask mandates. Right, Christ against culture would say that the government is evil and trying to control us. Right, the greatest threat is coming from culture, and so resist the tyranny. Right, right. Don't let them tell us what to do. We need to keep them at bay. Christ of culture, the experts have the best of society in mind. Trust the science. Christ above culture, we must work with the community as we continue to elevate the culture through religious practice. And so do your part, right? Do your role. Christ and culture in paradox, as citizens of the world, we should join in the suffering as we work towards health. And so just wear the darn mask, right? That's your part as a citizen of earth. And Christ transforming culture, and I kind of am going to go two routes with this, because as we've talked about, Christ transforming culture is people who feel the need to change, and people see that change necessary in a few different ways. One would be that this mass can be redeemed as a sign of love and sacrifice for our neighbors, and so I wear this mask for others. That would be a redemptive way of looking at it. There's also in the same camp those who see the transformation that needs to happen in culture as we need to actually push towards a greater understanding of the whole person, right? That right now the way that mandates are being put on people doesn't recognize all of our needs as human beings, right? Mental health, socialization. And so another way of transforming would be to say, we are more than bodies, right? It would be looking to change the way that these things are being viewed. Now, this is a summary. You can see, though, how different perspectives lead to different conclusions. And I hope that with all the work that we have done, that you can respect all of these models, even if you don't agree with them across the board. Because respect is different than agreement. To respect someone is to acknowledge that their position is grounded, that their position has some merit, that they are worth interacting with. The alternative to respect would be dismissing them, right? It would be saying, you are not someone who is worth my time. And so I hope that we can see all of these models as worth careful study and consideration. And not just for the sake of unity, not just so that we can all get along, but because this process helps shape us. Now, I want to remind you of the verse that we're using as a basis for this study, right? Romans 12:2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. As I ended last week, what Paul is encouraging us here is to read the Bible and then discuss it with others and put it into practice, right? Test these ideas and then return to the Bible and discuss it with others and put it into practice and go through this process over and over. And what this helps us to do is remember that we are in the process of being transformed. And God gave us his word and others and this life to do that. Now, part of this transformation comes from interacting with ideas and perspectives that are not our default, right? Considering things from another angle. And part of what I hope we get from this study is a benevolent view of those who differ with us. Right, I hope we can see the good in perspectives that aren't necessarily ours. And to do this, we must begin by recognizing the strengths of each model. Now, as we went through the list, we kind of talked about strengths and weaknesses at the end, but I want to quickly summarize these. I want to begin by acknowledging that the strength of each model lies in what it is attempting to solve, the problem that it sees that it is trying to address. See, people are drawn to specific models because they see a deficiency in the relationship of Christ and culture. They see something the church isn't doing that the church has been called to do. And they take their position, they take their perspective because they're saying, this actually solves the problem that I see as the greatest problem in the church. So a couple of examples, Christ against culture, right? It rightly identifies the lack of distinctiveness of Christians in the culture. Right, that many Christians look no different than their neighbors. That's the problem that someone sees, and they say the solution to that is actually for the church to pull back from culture and so that it can be different. They rightly see that the church has become corrupted and weakened through its relationship with culture. That as we interact with culture, culture infiltrates the church as much as church affects the culture. And so again, they're seeing that problem. There are people who sit in church and look around and go, man, we are no longer distinct. And so the strength of the Christ against culture model is in its clear teaching of right and wrong and a desire to live out the otherness of God. The Christ of culture rightly acknowledges that the church can easily become a club, so distinct that it no longer speaks to the world in a way that the world understands. It rightly acknowledges that people are hurting in the world, that there are people who we are never going to interact with because we sit inside of our churches and it's not a comfortable place for people to come to. And so the strength of this model is that it breaks down the barriers through making the truth of God more accessible in both word and deed. It attempts to bring the word of God to where people are. Christ above culture. Christ above culture rightly acknowledges that the culture is unable to solve its own problems, right? It needs the wisdom and authority of the church. With this, that sometimes the church has become thin because it either pulls itself entirely away or connects itself entirely to culture. So it's trying to kind of play this other piece. And the strength of this model is that it sees an active church as necessary for the health of the culture. Christ and culture in paradox rightly points out that God's plan for all people and God's plan for his people require distinction. God has a plan for all human beings and his entire creation. He also has a plan for his people specifically. And so Christ and culture in paradox rightly sees how the church getting caught up in cultural battles weakens its witness. That oftentimes, again, when it's trying to solve the problems of the culture, it no longer actually plays its role as the church very well. And so the strength of this model is in keeping our dual citizenship defined, right? Not how it overlaps, but how it actually stays separate. And then Christ transforming culture rightly identifies God's concern for every part of culture and what happens when the church withdraws its role as preservers of culture. Right, it rightly sees that when churches pull out, the culture suffers. That God actually needs us to be going into the world to keep the culture, the world, from going to its absolute worst. And so the strength of this model is in how seriously it takes the Christian role in bringing God's dominion to bear in his creation. And in that, you can see that each one of these models identifies an area where the church is lacking. And it is attempting then to bolster that weakness, right? It sees the church is supposed to be all of these things, and each one of these focuses on a specific place that the church is not living out who it's supposed to be and kind of puts everything behind that. Another way that I've seen this described is in regards to the story of redemption, right? A quick sketch of the meta-narrative of Scripture describes the story of God as kind of a pathway from creation to fall to redemption to restoration, right? Each one of these models then elevates one part of that story, right? There's one part of the story that it sees as bigger or more important, right? So for creation, it's the Christ and culture in paradox. They focus on God's common grace and general revelation, what God has done for the whole creation. Fall, Christ against culture, right? They take sin very seriously. They see the fall as making every, you know, kind of infecting everything, and so that's why we have to separate ourselves from culture, because sin is pervasive. Redemption, Christ transforming culture, it focuses on Jesus' work of reclaiming his creation. That because Jesus has died and brought redemption, that his people are now called to be reconcilers in the same way. And then restoration, I put both Christ of culture and Christ above culture there, focusing on the realization of God's perfection, right? Actually trying to bring heaven to earth, trying to bring these two things together, trying to bring culture to a point where all of its problems are solved. Now, God's redemptive plan has a center, right? Not all parts of his story are equal, but that center is the gospel. And the work of Jesus on the cross fulfills creation, reverses the fall, completes redemption, and puts a seal on the promise of restoration. Right? The cross is where we get the motivation and hope for any of this work, any of these models. We also see that the cross works in all of these directions, not just one of them. The cross fulfills everything that people in all of these different models are trying to accomplish. He gives us the command to be holy, to proclaim, to live in the world, to seek the welfare of the city, to invest in the eternal kingdom, and to love our neighbor. And all of these commands are for us at all times. We don't get to go, well, I don't really want to be that one. As the church, we're going to focus on this one. We're just going to pretend like God didn't give us any of those other commands. No, these are all part of what it means to be the church. And so the solution is not to find the right model at the expense of all the others, but to see them all as part of this layered fabric of what God is doing. Now the question is, how do we do that? Right? Since all of these models use a kind of different overall structure, we can't just kind of let's take the best from each one and create an Uber model, right? Create the perfect model, and then we can be the church that does it right while everyone else is doing it wrong. It doesn't work like that. Instead, what we need to learn how to do is how to kind of apply the right model at the right time. We need to learn to kind of lean in the right direction when it calls for it. God gave us these varied perspectives because in this complex world, all of these approaches to culture become necessary at some point or time. And so now we come to the part of the class that we've been waiting for. Hopefully I've been waiting for it, right? How do we figure this out? How do we actually apply this to our lives? How do we figure out what we're supposed to do? Well, let me get there by introducing some tools that have been helpful in discernment for me. So I'm going to go through 6 tools. You had to know I wasn't just going to give you the answer. If you did the dig deeper study with us, right, where we kind of looked at different tools to apply to understanding the Bible, this is similar. It's different tools that you bring to the culture, different tools that you bring to discernment. Some issues, sometimes we'll use all of them, some will use some of them, but they're basically just kind of different things to apply so that we can figure out what are we supposed to be doing. So the first tool that I'm going to introduce to you is called Postures to Gestures. And this comes from the book Culture Making by Andy Crouch. After giving his breakdown of the various models, he encourages the reader to think of these models as gestures rather than postures. Right? A posture is a kind of a rigid way of standing. It's that way of saying, like, I am here, this is how you approach me, this is how I think. It doesn't change depending on who you're interacting with. I would say if you've ever met a Marine who just got back from boot camp, right? It's like, man, you don't know how to relax anymore. They have drilled that posture into you, right? It's like that posture all the time. In regards to these models, then, it means picking your camp and interacting with every part of culture in the same way, right? Taking everything through the same system, through the same lens, always being against or always being of or always being transforming. Now, a gesture, on the other hand, changes based on who you're talking to, right? If a threatening person comes up to you, you're going to kind of stiffen. You're ready to attack. You're a little defensive. If you're talking to friends, you can assume a certain amount of agreement. You can talk kind of comfortably to friends. If you're talking to a group of people you don't know, you're kind of going to approach that differently because you don't know what the people in the audience are thinking. When you talk to a child, you kind of bend down and come down to their level so they're not intimidated by your massive height. Some of us do that no matter who we're talking to, right? But the idea is that we change our gestures based on the situation, right? We change our gestures based on what is appropriate for the time. And the suggestion is that each of these models has a time and place. We just need to learn how to use them appropriately. We need to learn how to read the situation so that we can use the right gesture. Which brings us to the second tool, which is called the Know the Season tool. The second tool helps us with this. This tool is borrowed from D.A. Carson's Christ and Culture Revisited. It's also referenced in the book Center Church by Tim Keller. The basics of this tool is that because different cultures require different gestures, it's important for us to know where our culture is. What season are we in? What exactly is the general flavor of the culture we're interacting with? And so they broke it down into actual seasons. It's easier to remember. Goes like this, winter, right? Winter is when the church has very little to no bearing on the culture, and the culture is hostile to Christianity. The church is in a weakened position and is struggling spiritually. That's either because Christianity has just come into a place, or they've actually cycled through the rest of the seasons and gotten to a place where Christianity has basically been pushed out entirely and it needs to rebuild. Spring, this is when the church is in conflict with the culture, possibly even persecuted, but the church is thriving and growing under these conditions. If you look at China, if you look at India, if you look at a lot of places where there's still a hostility towards Christianity, but somehow the church is really thriving in that. The persecution is not slowing anything down. So they don't have a huge role in the culture or in the society in terms of, like, you know, they're not in positions of power, and yet the church is actually doing quite a bit from the grassroots, kind of from the bottom up. Summer, this is when the church is highly regarded in the culture. Christians hold positions of power and authority, and it's a benefit to be part of the church, right? So it's easy. Culture and Christianity are basically moving in the same direction. And then there's autumn. This is where there's a growing hostility to the church and to the cultural power that it has held. People are leaving the church as it no longer brings the cultural benefit that it once did. And the argument is that this kind of cycle is just an ongoing cycle that you see throughout the world in terms of Christianity and culture. Now, in terms of the gestures that we have to consider then what is appropriate for each season. So for winter requires the church to strengthen itself and its identity and to develop a rich counterculture, to actually work on itself so that it understands what it is. And so a Christ against culture model actually is probably the most appropriate for that. The spring requires a healthy church to begin to invest in the culture for the sake of changing it, right? So the church has some power, the church is healthy, but now that health needs to bleed out into the culture so that it begin to kind of grow the culture in a way that is in line with God. And so Christ transforming culture would be kind of the best gesture at that point. Summer requires the church to protect itself against corruption as it coexists with culture, right? What happens when Christianity is dominant in culture is that the culture starts to bleed into the church quite a bit. And so it requires making sure that that distinction remains. And so Christ and culture and paradox is probably the best then. And then autumn requires the church to reimagine how it will reach out and make the gospel meaningful to a culture that has become complacent, right? As people begin to go, we don't understand culture anymore, we don't understand Christianity anymore, the church needs to find kind of creative and imaginative ways to reach out to people and go, this is who we are, this is who Christ is. Now, these are rules of thumb. These are not hard lines to draw. This is just to kind of go like, okay, as we're reading where we're at and where we live, it's an important way to kind of go, what ways should we be kind of thinking about the culture that we're interacting with? For those who live in America, that's all of us. This country was founded by many people who had basically lived a portion of their lives in kind of a spring sort of vibe. They came here to America, and America almost from the beginning was more in a summer sort of relationship, right? Founded on a certain amount of Judeo-Christian principles, operating from a kind of common morality. So this country has been in a summer, a long summer, I would say. And depending on how optimistic or pessimistic you tend to be, we might still be in summer. Later summer. Some people would say we are in autumn. Some people, again, real pessimistic, probably say we're heading into winter any day now. But we're somewhere in that kind of, we have been a dominant force within the culture for a very long time, but right now there's a shift happening, right? Right. The church is not being looked at positively by the culture a good portion of the time. Again, if you live in the Bible Belt, it's still summer probably, but here on the coasts, things are starting to move in a different direction. That doesn't mean we toss out the models that fit better in winter, spring, but it does mean we consider the specific time and place we find ourselves and how that affects our relationship with the culture. We allow the season to challenge us to lean in ways that might not be our default, right? If you grew up in kind of a summer, that's how you've learned to interact with the culture, that it's on board, that we kind of move along with each other, that it's kind of this, if the season changes, we need to somewhat think about what that means for how we have to change in our reaction and our response and our relationship with culture. Now, culture is not a single entity, right? And so it's not just about, okay, adopt one of these and apply it to everything. Culture is a lot of different things. There are layers and layers. There are multitude of different aspects. And so while we can recognize kind of the greater forces at play, we also have to kind of learn how to approach each and everything individually. And so for that, we need another tool. Tool number three helps us with this. It is the receive, reject, redeem tool. And you see variations of this tool in a lot of different writings. Luther has kind of this three-part breakdown. Kuyper has this three-part breakdown. Miroslav Volf, the Croatian theologian, writes it this way. He says, one, adopt it as something acceptable, whatever you're viewing from culture. Two, take up the element but transform it. Or three, reject it and even work to abolish it in a society for the good of all. I'm simply going to use the terminology receive, reject, redeem, because it's an alliteration, and pastors are obsessed with alliterations. sometimes far too much. I look at guys' sermons and every single like breakdown, three-part breakdown is like, read this, read that, read. You have no idea what I'm talking about. That's fine. But the general idea is this, right? Every topic and issue and sphere of culture must be weighed by the Bible. In a way, every element of culture is in the category of redeem. Every single thing, again, has both sin and good in it. But we have to ask how far down either of these roads it has gone, right? We have to weigh these things and say, how do we handle the things that come at us from culture? And so there's things that are mostly good, right, that we can look at and go, as Christians, we can interact with these things without having to make too many modifications to our own morality, right? There's mostly good with some sinful distortion, and these things should be received and celebrated as good. Those things we should actually look at the good and say, thank you, God, for giving us these things, right? Steak is one of those things, right? Civic celebrations, cultural food, some art, music, some of these sorts of things, we can look at and say, this is a good thing given to us by God. We should celebrate it and receive it. There are then those things that are created good but have become so distorted by sin and corruption that to engage with them is damaging to us. It actually, there's no way to interact with it without becoming corrupted, right? An example of that is pornography. Right? God created sex good. It has now become distorted in pornography to a point that there is no way for a Christian to have a healthy relationship with pornography. And I would say even softcore porn, no matter whether you call it a Netflix original movie or what you want to call it, we have to kind of look at these things and go, this is not good for us. There's no way for us to engage with this that we can redeem. And so those things need to be rejected. In the redeem category, then, are those things that are where the good and the bad are both evident, but it's possible to interact with them in a way to push them towards good, right? So we look at the thing and we go, man, that has been abused throughout society, but it still is something that can be redeemed, and so we just need to learn how to interact with it in a way that is good. The example that I have here is positions of power and authority. Right, in our culture, positions of a power and authority have been abused. And one of the reasons they've been abused is because power is corrupting. If you are in a position of power, it's very easy to be drawn into authoritative leadership and abuse, beginning to believe that there's something wonderful about you that has put you in this position. And so taking on a position of power in a company or in government is fraught with temptations and the potential to pull someone further and further and further from the good of God. Because our culture doesn't define power in the way that God does, right? Our culture doesn't look at positions of power and go, we are looking for some servant leaders, right? No, they're looking for someone who can come in and make things happen. They're looking for someone who can dominate. And so if you are someone who is called into a position of power, you have to take that very seriously and go, how can I live this out? How can I engage with this to bring God into this position of power rather than allowing this position of power to draw me away from him? In this, you are working then to redeem even this small part of culture. Now, good Christians disagree with what goes in what category. It's not so easy as to just go, okay, well, this goes in reject, this goes in redeem. I know when I was growing up, a lot of kids went to camp and like secular music was in the reject camp, you know, or in the reject category. They'd come home from camp and they'd be like, I'm going to get rid of all my CDs. And I bet like, give them to me, I'll get rid of them. And I had quite a CD collection from all the kids getting rid of their secular CDs, right? Because we had a different view of what needed to be rejected. I personally tried to redeem such things. Right? But the point is this. It's not so easy as for me to kind of go, let me give you the black and white categories. Here's the things that we as a church are not going to do. But this gives you at least a structure to start looking at things and weighing it and going, what does the Bible say about this? And what is actually good for me and not good for me? Which brings us to our fourth tool, right? In terms of the what is good for me and not good for me. And that is the tool of know yourself. Right? Be honest with your weaknesses. In the same way that some people should reject alcohol while other people can receive or redeem it, we all have elements that we need to be wary of. We all have things that are especially tempting and possibly corrupting to us. We all have different limits, and we need to be aware of them as we begin to kind of categorize and put our lines down and try to figure out how to have a healthy relationship with culture. Now, the other side of the Know Yourself tool is to be honest about your personality, right? Recognize the passions and the convictions that God has given you. As we said before, each one of these models was designed to press in and respond to a place where the church was weak, which means each one of these is God showing people something that the church should be doing. It's giving people the eyes to see what needs to be changed. And so it's important to learn how to read the culture. It's important to learn how to know the season. But we also need to talk about how God has designed each and every one of us in particular. Because if God is working on all of these different fronts, we need to be confident about how he has called and equipped us. Right? What specifically has he made us to do? This tool will help you to narrow your focus. This will help you to not feel like you have to be part of every single thing that's happening in the world, like every culture war and every movement and every good thing. Right? There's a lot happening. And if you look at it all, sometimes you're just like, I'm not doing enough, I'm not doing... But if you know yourself, you can look and go, where has God placed me? What has he given me a passion to do? There's other people doing other great things, and you can acknowledge that and go, that's awesome they're doing that. I'm never going to do that. Viewing yourself as part of the multifaceted work of God keeps you from feeling like you're never doing enough, or the need to make enemies with people who are engaging the culture differently, right? Because that's how we justify what we're doing. I can only do this much. I can't do that over there, so they must be wrong. So then I'll feel better about myself that I can't do that over there if I can demonize them and make this the really, really important thing. And this happens all the time. Right, I mean, these models are known for like these people arguing, like, I'm this one and you're stupid, right? I mean, like, that's kind of how people end up, like, I identify over here and so I identify as not part of your club. And it just is not the way that God designed it to be. Now, along with convictions and weaknesses that God has given you, it's also important to ask how much ability you actually have to change the world. This is our fifth tool. Called the optimism-pessimism spectrum. It's a weird name for a tool. I don't know. It would have been a long day. Now, when you're young, people tell you that you can do whatever you want and that you will change the world. Right? And colleges are filled with people with like bright eyes and they are going to do everything and the world is going to be different and everyone's going to know their name, right, and this sort of thing. And most young people leave college with a high level of optimism that they will play a major role in changing the world. And then they try to do that, and they get pretty beat up. So much so that there's this little thing called midlife crisis, right? A good part of what midlife crisis is I thought I was going to do a bunch of things, and I've been doing things for 20 years, and I haven't done anything. I feel like I haven't made any headway. Now, one solution to this would be to teach young people to be more pessimistic, but that just seems negative, even for me, right? Crushing the dreams of young people. No, a better way is to refine how we view our cultural impact based on this optimism-pessimism spectrum. Now, this is not about the glass being half full or half empty. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about optimism and pessimism. I'm talking about prioritizing where you spend your time and your energy. See, when you look at any sort of specific issue, right, a thing that we believe must be kind of fought against or redeemed or celebrated, right, there's kind of a lot of things to be done. There's a number of ways that we can play our role in society, and we should aim for the ones where we are optimistic about our ability to have an impact. In what way can I engage with this that I can actually be effective? Where I can be the person who God created me to be, and I can actually do something and feel like I'm contributing. To make sense of this, let me take a specific issue that I know some in our church are very passionate about, adoption and foster care. Right? If God has given you a heart for adoption and foster care, you recognize this as a need that must be addressed. Now you have to decide what to do, right? I want to see something change. I want to see something done. What can I do? Well, there's a lot of things you can do. I put down 10, right? You can work to reform the system because the system is broken. You can work on advocacy for the rights of children because children are being just torn around and they don't have a voice in the process. You can lobby to make better laws. You can be someone who champions the cause and recruits people to it. You can be a parent who's willing to actually bring children into your home. You can be a support for the families who are doing this. I can't do that all the time, but I can support people who are. You can be a financial help for adoptive parents, right? Because it costs like $30,000, I think, for domestic adoption at this point, $30,000, $40,000. So you can say, hey, I can't do it, but I can contribute to that. You can be a social worker. You can support social workers, because once you become a social worker, you realize that is a difficult job. Or you can be there for the people in difficult situations to prevent more kids from going into the foster care system, right? Like support the families who are struggling so that it doesn't overload the system. Now, this is just 10 things. This is not all the things. But the point is, these responses land in all the models somewhere, right? This is kind of all over the map. And what each of us have to ask is, what part can I actually be optimistic about? Right? What part can I actually do? What part can I actually change? Now, if you happen to be someone who already has a role in government or you have a place in lobbying, like you could say, I'm already a lobbyist. I'm already in government. I can play that part. I'm there. I have a place as a leader of a small community, right? What that means is I have the ability to communicate to a group of people. I can kind of play that champion recruiter role better than a lot of people who don't have any sort of people that they don't have much social clout. Right? If you know people involved in one level or another, you can have a direct effect in the lives of the people who are already doing some of the work. Right? So you know a family who's already adopter in foster care, you can go to them and say, how can I help you specifically? You already have that connection, and you can go, man, I know I can do something there. My point is this. You have to ask how your response to culture can be most effective, right? What you can be most optimistic about bringing change to. And I say this because what most people do is they aim for the top. They go, I want to have the biggest effect, I want to have the biggest impact, and so I'm going to go with politics and celebrity and major movements. I'm going to get involved in some sort of, you know, Twitter campaign, whatever it is. People want to be connected to large-scale change. They want to be connected to the thing that is going to make the news and, you know, we eradicated the foster problem in this state, these sorts of things. But very few of those things actually ever pay off. People invest so much time and money and effort into these things that don't actually have any chance of ever working. Instead, if we can take an accurate view of the little bit that we can do, what we can be optimistic about, then we can be content with the small part that we get to play. And so the change that happens, right, in going from I'm really optimistic as a college person and then I'm really pessimistic and depressed as a middle-aged person, is you change your perspective as to what changing the culture, what changing the world actually means. And you start to realize that God didn't mean for us to change the entire world, but to have an impact where we are. That's my act locally rant. There you go. All right, I got one more tool. Seek the center. Now, this one I totally just ripped off. This one I'm stealing directly from the book Center Church by Tim Keller. He's developed this great little chart, and so I wanted to use it because I think some people are visual learners, and this is a helpful visual tool that says a lot of the things. I don't know why you wouldn't love my chart with all the side-by-side words, but, you know, some people like pictures. He uses a couple of different, slightly different terminology. For Christ against culture, he calls that counterculturalists. Christ of and above culture, he has renamed relevance. Christ and culture and paradox, he calls two kingdoms. And Christ transforming culture, he renamed transformationist, which isn't very creative. It's right there, but that's cool. Now, why I find this chart really helpful is not only that it gives us a visual description of where they land in regards to common grace and level of activity. If you, it's hard to see. So the two on the top are, it's kind of view of common grace. So the two on the bottom, little common grace, much common grace, passive in influencing culture, active in influencing culture. So you kind of have this spectrum of where they land. At the center, these perspectives all bring a valuable and necessary part of the church's relationship with culture, right? And so what you can see is as you come to the center, they all kind of converge at this place where they're all bringing their positives together. And the further you get from the center, the more you lose part of what you are called to be. You become a much more of an extremist who is doing part of the role, but not the whole thing. And so to seek this center is to ask the question, how can I use the strengths of the other positions to bolster my own views and pull me towards a more complete view? At times, the church needs to lean a little harder in one direction in order to correct where it has gone too far. Right? So when the church gets a little too far this way, or when an individual gets a little bit too far this way, to seek the center is to say, how can I pull myself back by using some of these other tools or some of these other models? How can I pull myself back to that which is a more complete and full view? Now, this is one of the things that played a role in some of the decisions that the elders had to make about masks as an elder board. We asked the question, is the church in general respecting and honoring the government and science too much or not enough? Right? So when people look at the church, do they go, yeah, they're doing their job to honor and respect the governing authorities? I don't think that's what most people are saying. I think when most people see the church, they see a people who are like, we have our rights and we're able to do what we want because the government can't tell us what to do because we are bound by God, not by the government. And so part of what we looked at is if we are trying to kind of bring the church more towards the center, if we're trying to help us to understand how all of these things play together, we're going to lean in the direction that we think gets us there. All right, we have six tools. Postures to gestures, know the season, receive, reject, redeem, know yourself, optimism, pessimism, and seek the center. And what I want to do to kind of end today is take a single issue and run it through all of this. And so we're going to take an issue that is not controversial at all, abortion. And we're going to do that because I think it's important to see not only what it looks like as we run it through this, but because it is something that the different models land in different places on. And not necessarily, well, we'll get to that. It's going to help us determine what is the best approach that we should take as both individuals and as the church in regards to abortion. So first is we're going to skip over postures and gestures. We're going to hit that at the end. First, we're going to go with the Know the Season tool. So abortion has been part of our culture since the beginning. Abortion has always been something that people sought out, but it was the Roe v. Wade decision, right, in 1973 that made it 100% legal in America. Since then, roughly 63 million babies have been aborted legally in the United States. And so at this point, the right to abort is entrenched in our culture, right? It is part of, for many people, what it means to be free, what it means to have rights. Also, the rate of abortions has been dropping since the early 80s. That's good news. Down from nearly 30 abortions per 1,000 women to just under 13 per 1,000 women last year. And so as a culture, we have far fewer abortions, yet the belief that it is a fundamental right is stronger. I don't know if it's stronger than it's ever been, but it's certainly strong. That is a strong belief that our culture puts out there. So we can't call the season exactly, but it seems like while opposition to making abortion illegal is still strong, the work of the church has had an impact, right, in bringing down the demand for abortion and lives being saved. All right, receive, reject, redeem tool. This one's a little bit easier. Abortion is the taking of a life. That's forbidden by the Ninth Commandment. Abortion is directly opposed to the cultural mandate to fill the earth and subdue it. because it is doing the exact opposite of what God called us to do. And it goes against the Imago Dei, that human life has value because each person is made in the image of God. In this, there is no biblical case to receive it, nor can it be redeemed because there is no way to fix or repair something that actually ends a life. It can't be undone. Now, let me be clear. When I say that it can't be redeemed, I don't mean that someone who has had an abortion cannot be redeemed. I'm not saying there's not forgiveness for that. What I'm saying is the act itself cannot be fit into a Christian worldview. There's no way to receive or redeem abortion. It has to be rejected, and not just rejected. It has to be pushed back against by the church. All right, the Know Yourself tool. There are many who will argue that this is the issue of the church, that if you don't put your time and attention to this issue, that you are failing as a Christian, that you are not actually seeing what God has called us to in this moment. And I would argue that God is fully capable of accomplishing this without us elevating it above all other things. That God actually did not equip and call every single person to make that their main fight. And I think that if we make that our main fight and tell everyone this is what you're supposed to be doing, we miss out on all the things, all the sins that God wants us to be pushing back against. And so I believe that we need to allow people to pursue that which God is drawing them to, what passions and convictions he has given them, rather than telling them that their gospel passions are not important because they aren't as pressing or as big. We should be encouraging one another to act on and care about all of the ways that sin is causing destruction. And many people will be drawn to this cause specifically because it is so atrocious and because it is so personal to a lot of people. Optimism, pessimism. Based on the season that we are in, overturning Roe v. Wade is a tall task. Right? Not saying it's impossible, not saying it's never going to happen, but putting all of our eggs in that basket, doing all of our work at that level, I think misses out on a lot of other ways that we could actually be helping out. The legislative means that are happening all over the country, right? You see these kind of bills passed. They seem to move forward and then move backward, and then move forward and then move backward, and then move forward and then move backward, depending on the season or the year. And speaking for myself only, right? Constantly aiming at that draws me to pessimism, draws me to going, we're fighting this battle, we're you know, trying to get certain people elected, and then we still have this. It's still there. On the other hand, being able to serve and help those who are struggling or who made the decision to keep their child, right? Helping the person who's right in front of you, that's something that I can achieve. And again, this doesn't mean everyone, I mean, the whole optimism, pessimism, and know yourself is know yourself. Speaking for myself, right, our church supports the local Pregnancy Resource Center. Esther and I have been active there in various roles. And we do that specifically because that is a way that I can actively push back and be part of, again, pushing back against the sin of abortion, where I can see the change. I can be optimistic that I can actually do something because I can show up. I can do a couple things. And so we need to, again, look at where are we putting our time and energy? What are the things in this that we are actually investing in? In the last year, our church helped to buy some, a bed and some other things for a mom who had decided to keep her kid and needed some help through the Pregnancy Resource Center. Esther and I taught a parenting class over there for a while. We support them financially. Again, there's lots of ways there, but there's also lots of ways just in our communities. There's lots of people who are struggling, lots of people who need help. And so it's in that just a matter of keeping our eyes open. All right, we'll address the postures and gestures and seek the center after we have thought through. What I want to do is look at how each model views abortion, specifically the approach of each of these models and how they kind of, how they view the churches and the Christian response to the culture in this. And then we'll look at the seeking the center and the postures and gestures. All right, so Christ against culture. Right, Christ against culture would say abortion is evil and we should do everything we can to fight against it. Right, it is it is something that is evil. And again, some of the Christ Against Culture people say, what we're going to do is create a little monastic community over here and not engage with it at all. But for a lot of the people in that camp, the reaction to the culture makes it a fight. Christ of Culture says women's rights are important, and while abortion is bad, it's one of the many sins, and it must be available so that women are not oppressed. And so it would say there's lots of sins going on. Abortion is one of them, but ultimately it is a necessary sin in order to elevate this other good. Christ Above Culture says abortion should not be overturned, but it is morally wrong. And I know that's confusing, and this is why in the Catholic Church you have the Catholic Church making a very clear statement as to what the church, how the church views abortion, and yet the abortion rates within the Catholic Church are high. And their view towards abortion is actually, keeping it legal. Christ and Culture and Paradox. Abortion is a sinful reality of our culture, and we should both avoid it ourselves, right? We should teach our children that it's not an option, and push back against it as individuals in the culture. And then Christ Transforming Culture. It's our Christian responsibility to live out our faith in such a way that abortions are no longer necessary. In the transforming camp, you have both the people who are trying to do that from a legislative standpoint and the people who are trying to do that by setting up all sorts of different systems and things to basically rescue people out of the need the desire to solve their problems by aborting a child. So the question is, what does it look like to seek the center here? Well, I'd say it depends on where you are. Right, if you're an abortion abolitionist, I have some friends who have taken up the cause of abortion abolitionists, that there is nothing short of abolishing it and imprisoning anyone who's part of it. I would say seeking the center is, it's important to remember that there are hurting people involved, that just kind of setting kind of hard lines doesn't recognize the reason why people are actually in these situations and sometimes comes across as really harsh in a way that isn't ever heard by people on the other side. Trying to force the culture in a direction rather than working with it to change has not always worked out well for the church or the people they're trying to help. Church works better as salt and light than as a hammer. That's what I have here. Now, if you're in the or above camp, I would say that you need to take a long look at what the Bible calls us to. You need to take a long look at how the Bible actually defines life and question whether or not you're actually submitting to God's ideals or if you're allowing the culture to actually pull you along and shape your view of the world. For the Christ and Culture and Paradox people, I think it's worth letting some of the passion of the against and the transforming people to influence you a little bit. Sometimes the Christ and Culture and Paradox people get a little bit too comfortable with the tension. I get a little bit too comfortable with, like, sin's always going to be here, we're always going to have problems, we can only do so much, and don't have, like, this passion to see change. And so seeking the center is actually letting 63 million lives lost, right? That's not something we can be complacent about. For the transforming people, it might be necessary to be honest about the limitations of change. Right, about how much transforming we can actually do, about how much of an impact we can have, because there's a lot of talk, but not necessarily as much change. Now, as for the gestures and postures, remember that you may have the opportunity to talk to a crowd of people you don't know about the evils of abortion, and you might also in your life speak with a woman who has just found out she is pregnant and is terrified. I have had both of those options numerous times in my life. And recognize that both of those conversations require different gestures. But it isn't just about talking one way over here and talking one way over here. It's actually about having both of those situations affect how you view the other. Right? You have to think about how to show the love and grace of God to the scared mother when you're talking to the crowd, because she might be in attendance. And so this isn't just about learning to change gears depending on the issues in the culture, but it's about interacting with Christ and culture in a way that sanctifies us as God intended, softens us, allows us to be both serious about the truth, but also passionate about the lost and the hurting. And the only way to do this is to be continually allow yourself to be shaped by God through others, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm going to end there because I created more questions than I gave answers today, and we'll do some questions now. Give Andrew a second. Turn it off. Is it off? All right. I threw a lot of stuff.